Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
There's probably not one business in the world that hasn't had a fail, you know, and I think any success has to come about via failure. You learn from a failure, therefore you adapt and pivot, and you then therefore success ensues. So,
this is Property Investory, where we talk to successful property investors to find out more about their stories, mindset, and strategies. I'm Tarun Shum. And in this episode, we'll continue the conversation with Paul and Pascal Avril to delve into their property investing strategies, particularly overseas in the UK, to find out about their insight on mindset and why they chose to invest and all the tips, tricks, and lessons they've learned along the way. Successful in their previous investments, Pascal shares what the initial strategy was when it came to investing.
It's because we were both complete rookies when we started, it's been a real journey of learning along the way. So we've done pretty well. We always could have done better in the beginning, and also our strategy and our endpoint, our goals have developed along the way. So in the beginning, the first one that I bought was so that I could have a place to live. But as it followed on from that, we really like it. And it wasn't until that we got to Australia, actually, that we came across the strategy of negative gearing. Because in New Zealand, you can't depreciate a property. You used to be able to, but you can't do that so much. So there's less negative gearing that goes on in New Zealand. And we came to Australia and realized what a big strategy it is for a lot of people, but we weren't quite on board with it. It wasn't really our comfort level. We understood what was going on in Sydney and Melbourne at the time, and that people were just buying properties, refinancing within 2 years, buying more, and really successfully growing their portfolios. But we also understood the downside of that, which is what can happen in a recession with the drop in property prices. And we didn't have so much comfort around being tied to topping up properties and having to pay that difference no matter what happened. So we went for the cash flow strategy.
And why, due to market instability, they chose to refrain from having a negatively geared portfolio?
Well, our whole portfolio is positively geared. So we've got nothing that's negatively geared. I mean, neutral is sort of break-even neutral is probably the closest we've gotten to negative gearing. So I see why, I mean, both of us sort of agree on this. We see why negative gearing can be a strategy for many, but I would say for every one that does well from it, there's many who have found themselves in a difficult situation if they, you know, maybe fell into the trap of buying in a mining town, you know, before that ended and so on. So while negative gearing is a strategy, certainly not one that we adopt. We're definitely the positive gearing and definitely the cash flow. Getting cash flow is important to us.
Thinking about their property experiences this far, Paul and Pascal recall of a time where their investing moments didn't go quite as planned.
We haven't had anything that's really lost a whole lot of money or gone really, really pear-shaped. But what we have done is come close, very, very uncomfortably close to losing a lot of money a number of times. So it's been the real discomfort. And we've made decisions that we've really, really learned from and looked back and gone, well, we're never going to do that again. But it's around things like being sure of getting the lending at one point, but when the property actually comes through, times have changed, timelines have changed, and there's a high probability that we just couldn't get lending and may have to walk away and walk away from our deposit. And that came through literally with a day to spare. I think that if the bank hadn't been slightly flexible on the time frame, because it was around the Christmas time frame when everything came through, we would have gone belly up. some similar types of things with, actually it seems to be lending stories with lending on in the UK as well, that just ended up being a lot more difficult than we thought it would be, but came through in the end. But because it was the UK, I remember just midnight phone calls, or I remember sitting in bed and it was 1 a.m. or 3 a.m. and we were just waiting for a call, I think, from the bank saying what they'd valued the property at, because we were waiting to make sure that it was going to be enough to cover what we needed. Though we had gone through a period where there'd been some uncertainty about valuations in the UK, and we were holding hands and just holding our breath for this number to come through. And in the end, it did come through. It was what we needed, but it was just very, very close.
With such changing conditions and the emotional strain property decisions can sometimes have on an individual, Paul expands on why property investing is an emotional process, even though people say it shouldn't be.
People say that property shouldn't be an emotional thing, but, you know, it is. Let's face it, it is. But yeah, you know, and we had plan Bs and plan Cs and plan Ds in place, but it doesn't take away the anxiety that comes with getting things over the line. That one with the UK, for example, was again, it was like a hair's breadth that we got it through over the line.
With that in mind, Paul takes us to another one of his and Pascal's worst investing moments.
I mentioned that I was living in the house in Christchurch for a while, renting out all the rooms. And so that I was managing that myself. I didn't have an agent or anything. So that was, you know, just a self-managed property. And I had for the most part, I had really good tenants, and I was quite, I had good insight into people, I think, and I can see someone in general. I definitely didn't have a really rigid process of vetting people before they came in. I usually went on a, hey, this person seemed like a good person, looks like they're pretty secure and stable. I've had a couple that didn't quite do that. I mean, one guy, I got up one morning, because I lived there, I got up one morning about 7 a.m., walk into the kitchen, and he's there in the kitchen. I say, how are you doing? Good morning. And he looks up at me, and he'd obviously just got home, and he was, I don't know if you know the term, off his chops, but he was so out of it that he couldn't put together a sentence. He couldn't actually articulate what he was saying at that point. And I don't think it was alcohol, but so yeah, I literally kicked him out the next day. And the other one, yeah, this was all in the lead up to the, funnily enough, the earthquake, because I would have another guy who just made an absolutely trashed the place, his room and the bathroom at the time. Not in an aggressive way, just drunken idiocy. At that point, and again, the day I kicked that guy out was the morning of the Christchurch earthquake. So I walked home. The earthquake happened. I walked home that afternoon, walked up my driveway to see the wall. We had one brick wall, one double brick wall on one side. That had pretty much mostly fallen down, and I could see my bed through the wall. It wasn't there anymore. And so the feeling of walking up my drive and seeing that the house was devastated, that was probably a really, really dark and low moment in terms of investment. And I was thinking, well, now what? You know, so that was really difficult. But you know, with that said, you learn from those things, and you learn lessons, and and there's a huge mindset shift in dealing with those kind of things. It's strengthening.
Faced with such devastating outcomes, what exactly did Paul do to move on from that point in his investing career?
Well, I mean, there's a big psychological shift that happens when you go through a major event like that, because there's actually guilt. I had quite a lot of guilt associated with going through the earthquake and actually living through the earthquake, where not many people didn't. Survivor guilt, yeah. And so that was one thing psychologically, but in terms of sort of financially and everything, I was one of the people who had insurance, and we made sure that I was. When I first started buying property and buying that property, I made sure I had the risk management sorted out. So that was one of the massive things that got us through, is that we were able to use that risk management strategy and put it into place. So we got it. Our insurance actually sent a team out quite quickly. And I think I was fortunate in getting hold of them before everybody started calling, you know, their insurance. So I was lucky in getting in quite early, and they came out and made my house safe to live in and habitable within about 3 weeks of the earthquake. So I could then start renting rooms again very quickly and live there. It wasn't perfect, but certainly it was in a state that could be lived in, Pascal.
And just so you know, Tyrone, what was quite common in Christchurch at the time was people would have to move out of their property and would end up having to rent, and they would be renting at a premium because properties were, there was a shortage, and they were also paying the mortgage still on their destroyed property. So it was a really, really tough financial time for a lot of people, and we were lucky in that sense.
With emotions running high and people still being affected by the earthquake, Paul shares how grateful he is for the outcome he found himself in, and why it's his exit strategy that allowed him to get back on his feet.
Even now, we're how many years now? Eight, nine years since the quake. There's people who still haven't really gotten everything sorted with their properties and insurances and so on, and obviously the psychology. But yeah, so there's a lot of people who actually are still really struggling and trying to survive over there, albeit that they've gotten through it. With that particular property, in the end, it was habitable, it was livable, it was rentable, but I didn't want to be there anymore. And so what worked for me, my exit strategy from that was, at the time, in the sort of preceding 2 years, the following 2 years, there was a lot of property that was safe to live in, it's on okay land, but it wasn't insurable anymore. For a new purchase, if you were a new buyer on an existing property and that had been through the earthquake, it was unlikely you were going to get insurance. So there were many investors jumping in who were just buying at auctions for very low amounts. It's called as is where is. So at the time, you go onto the realestate.com version of in New Zealand, and it says property for sale as is where is, which means no insurance, buy it at your own risk. So a lot of investors would come and buy property at auction very cheap and then rent it out because they don't care if the property isn't insured. Like later on, they can knock it down and build or develop. So I sold mine at an auction in the end. And with that and the insurance and everything, I was able to walk away from the property with enough to be able to start again, which is what we did when we got to Adelaide.
While these were certainly circumstances that no investor should ever have to go through, Paul and Pascal share that there have been many times that made investing worth it.
I think Paul and I were discussing this recently, and we don't have a particular aha moment, probably other than the aha moment that I had in the beginning and Paul had in the beginning when we realized that actually property would work and it was something that we could do. Other than that, I think what's happened along the way is we've developed a sort of calculated risk appetite. And we have done a couple of things where we say, look, this is a good deal. We don't know how we're going to do it. We did this on a piece of land in New Zealand. It's going to be about a year before it. We have to settle on this. We know that we can figure out a way. And there is doing that, and there's being silly, and there's, you've got to try and find the middle ground in between. But we've found that we've been able to do this, and the steadfastness, I guess, of our nerves and being able to do those types of things has really developed. And that's been really cool, I think, because you can't move forward that much without having a little bit of the ability to do that.
Mentioning one of the UK investments, Paul and Pascal explain the details surrounding this particular property purchase and how they were able to purchase property overseas without actually being there.
We connected with a team over there, and we knew that the UK was a really viable option, and we already owned a few sort of what they call buy-to-lets, or we call here, your standard rental investments where you've got one tenant, one tenancy agreement.
And I'll just add in there, we also knew that non-UK residents could buy property in the UK by setting up a company, and that there would be not that many, but there would be some lenders that would be open to lending. So we knew it was possible.
And so what we couldn't do at the time is move to the UK, spend time finding the property, going through the purchase, renovating it. I don't have specific skills in renovation per se. So really it was about leveraging the right team and getting a reliable and trustworthy team to do the work. So we really had to try and build a good relationship with a reliable team. Difficult when you've never done it before and you've got to put a lot of trust into a team you've never met. But we spent a good amount of time doing our due diligence, making sure that we had the right team in place. The team that we found, which is now a company that we are looking to work with for moving forward, did an amazing job of sourcing the right property based on what we wanted. We knew what cash flow we wanted, we knew what our budget was, and they essentially offered a bespoke service that find a property, offer and do the full conversion, project manage it, find a letting agent or a rental agent who would then find tenants for us. So we didn't actually have to lay our hands on the property itself. We just managed the managers, let's say.
Having found a great company to work with, they shared the process they went through to source a reliable company.
Word of mouth, actually. I mean, we did do some property education, which led us to having a conversation with someone, which led us to looking. There was something called like a sourcing platform where you can find property sourcing agents via the platform. That didn't quite work out, but through that, we met the owner of this business. And through that, we decided to work with them. So it was actually sort of a number of different referrals that got us there.
And there's actually, there's a lot of sourcing agents in the UK, a lot of people that perhaps are into investing but don't have the capital yet, go and source properties and sell the deals on. And then you've got companies like the guys that we work with who have been doing it for years. And what they do is they can't buy every single property that they find. So they're also providing that service for other people. So there are a number of sourcing agents in the UK, and if you know that, it's just looking them up. The tricky thing is finding which ones are trustworthy and which ones aren't. And we actually got close to doing a couple of deals at one point, but because of our due diligence, we found some suspicious details and were able to challenge them and quickly back out before we committed. So we sort of wiped our brows because of that. So there was a little bit of a process, and I think it really did emphasize to us how much trust and the relationship is just so key. It's crucial to the success of something like this.
With the potential to have lost money while working with these companies, Paul also shares what they had learned in order to ensure the companies they worked with were legitimate and trustworthy.
So there's an education there, right? We had to do a lot of personal education around the compliance of property, what the legal system, how the legal system works, how the sort of property environment is. I had a fair amount of an idea what UK property was like, but certainly not with the model we use, HMO. There's a lot of compliance around, because you've got six tenants or more, you've got to deal with the fire alarm systems and the risk safety and that kind of thing. So yeah, lots to learn, and we needed to know about that. We couldn't just let somebody go and do it, because as soon as we got the keys handed over, we then needed to manage the letting agent as well. So you need to understand the property itself and how it works.
Another factor Paul and Pascal had to consider was the difference between UK financing and Australian financing, and if deposits are still required.
It depends on the lender, really. I mean, there are the big banks lenders that, and the interest rates are really good over there, say between 2-3% for somebody living there. Unfortunately, we didn't qualify for that kind of rate, but there are a number of, what do they call them, second tier lenders or non-bank lenders who have different levels of appetite. So the beautiful thing is often, yes, you have to put down a deposit. What we did in the beginning is we bought the property cash, and then we got a bridging loan, which was for 6 months at a higher interest rate, but it meant that we didn't need to show them a property that was in a rentable state, because it wasn't at that stage. And then when we'd bought it up to a rentable, so we were able to pull some money out from that to fund the conversion. And then after that 6 month period, we were able to show them some tenancy agreements, and we were able to move on to a long-term finance agreement onto a 5-year mortgage. So yes, you do often need a deposit in a way, I guess, but there's different ways that you can do it, such as that way. The beautiful thing about the UK is that they don't means test. So they're not asking us what our income is. It's really based on the history of the company. That's why it was so difficult for us in the beginning, because our company was new and it didn't have history. So actually we boiled down to, at the time, just one lender that was willing to help us out. And as time goes on and we're able to show our credit history and that we've been landlords for some time, we will get better and better offers come through. So it was doing the real hard yards in the beginning.
And what type of accounts and entities they needed in the UK in order for this to work?
The main thing was getting a bank account. You needed to actually be in the bank to set up the bank account. So we went to the UK to do that. And that's the one visit we made when with regards to this property. And at the same time while we were there, you know, we set up the business, the company name, the limited company and so on. But yeah, the main one thing is just the bank account. And we set up a limited liability company, LTD, which is managing the asset. And as Pascal said, the lender doesn't means test. They just look at the asset you're buying, what the return is going to be or what the value of that asset is, and the obviously history of the limited company as well.
And what that does mean for us is that we are kind of maxed out a little bit in our current situation in Australia and in New Zealand as well, because they do means tests. So they've said, okay, you have, what is it, 7 properties, that's all we're going to lend on. And especially with the lending has become tighter both in Australia and New Zealand. So if we didn't have the UK as an option, we would be starting to scratch our heads and think, how else would we do it? And I'm sure there are ways that we could be creative there. But the beauty is that we can push on with our investments in the UK uninhibited by the means testing.
Coming up after the break, we'll delve further into Paul and Pascal's overseas investing journey.
Until the markets in Australia and New Zealand shift, or the lending shifts a little bit more and becomes a little more comfortable for the lenders, we'll probably focus on the UK, yeah. And we're helping people who are also looking over there into the UK from Australia to find them as well.
While seeking out education and networking have been important parts of their journey so far.
But actually, you know, where a lot of our education has come from is a lot of reading, a lot of podcasts, a lot of workshops. And one of the biggest things is networking and growing around us like-minded people who have similar passions, similar values, and learning from each other. That's been massive.
And that's next. I'm Tarun Shum, and you're listening to Property Investory. Continuing on the subject of investing in the UK, Paul and Pascal shared the criteria they had in mind when looking for a property to purchase.
Well, we knew the budget and we knew the model. We knew what the model looked like and what was possible. So within the budget, we sort of say to them, yeah, look, this is what we've got available to invest. These guys have done hundreds of them, so they really know where to find them and how to find the good ones. And then what kind of cash flow we're looking at, really. So we knew we wanted the HMO model, and we knew we wanted good cash flow, 15% plus. And based on that, they go and say, okay, well, look, we've got these properties available, and they send us the sort of MO of the property and say, is this what you're looking for? And we do, this is again where the education is important, because we did then do our own due diligence on the area, the infrastructure, local letting rates and trends and so on, just to make sure that what we're getting is actually fundamentally going to be a good property. These guys are really good, but doesn't mean that we shouldn't be putting our own effort in to do the due diligence as well. So we give them, you know, as much information of what we want out of it, and they go and find it. It's a very a boutique service.
How did you also get a deal like this where you could actually put that many tenants in there too? Because was it because of the rate of return that you requested? That's why they had to structure this way? Because 6 tenants is almost buying like a unit or bunch of units.
The HMO model would be minimum 4. But what they say is 4 bedrooms will cover your costs. So just to give you a little bit of an explanation as well of the HMO model is the landlord pays for everything from the council taxes to the TV license, internet, the power. So everything is paid for. But the rent that we get in is a premium level of rent as well. So we know that in this model, about 4 bedrooms will cover costs. And then they say that any bedroom on top of that is like the cream. So that's where your profit comes from. So 5, 6 is really good. And it's often manageable as well. You can often get a 3-bedroom property and turn it into a 6-bed. But then you can get other types of properties. The really cool thing about the UK is that they've got things like old villas, but they've got old churches, they've got old office buildings, they've got high street shops that aren't being used anymore with the decrease in retail. They've got all these various types of buildings. And if you can get other bigger houses that can convert into 7, 8, 9 beds as well, then the cash flow just starts to really, really escalate. So we went with the 6-bed because that was where our budget was. But there is a lot of scope. I think there's HMOs that have sort of 19 beds and they're almost run like a boarding house. Yeah, I'm sort of thinking some of them are also, it's the typical student model, you know, like student accommodation. But a lot of these people actually living in this accommodation are young professionals, and that's who we have in our property. But yeah, it is almost like the hostel type thing where you have a big complex, but it is being done over there. There's a lot of those styles of accommodation, and it's because of the demand. I mean, there is definitely a huge demand for this type of accommodation.
With phenomenal returns, greater than those in the Australian market, and positive cash flow properties in their portfolio, Paul shares why they plan to continue investing in the UK market.
Well, like Pascal said, we've sort of almost capped here on this end. So until the markets in Australia and New Zealand shift, or the lending shifts a little bit more and becomes a little more comfortable for the lenders, we'll probably focus on the UK. Yeah, and we're helping people who are also looking over there into the UK from Australia to find them as well. And talk about numbers for a second. In the UK, the HMO model makes up about 18 to 20% of rentals in the UK. So single room lets. And that's because people can't afford to buy property. They can't afford to rent a whole house themselves. And for many people, they're working on contracts and not full time. So it's easier and it's more convenient for them just to move into a room that's private and it's got a bathroom and it's fully furnished. And all the bills are paid. They just need to pay their rent. It's very simple for them. So that's why it's a really strong model. And I don't think it's going anywhere for a long time.
While the generally cheaper property prices have drawn Paul and Pascal to the UK property market, they share that a good bargain still has to be sought out.
In the UK, the properties are quite a bit cheaper. And that's the amazing thing.
It depends where you look.
I guess it would be like comparing regional areas to Sydney, perhaps. If you buy in London, it's a completely different thing and you will end up being negatively geared per se there, or even in the south. A lot of people do capital strategies in the south where they'll buy a property, do it up, sell it on for a great profit. Whereas it's in the middle of England where the prices are still really low. Ours was... 88,000 pounds to purchase the property, which is equivalent of about $150,000. And yet the rent that we get in is about £1,000 per month. So that's
after expenses.
After everything. So that's what's that about? $1,800 at the moment. Mm. Yeah. So, and even our return on investment based on that is about 17%, but that is because we didn't pull out as much. We had to leave a little bit more in the property than we had expected. So if we had actually pulled out what we had estimated and what we probably will be able to do in a couple of years when the market and the valuations adjust again, and we have heard from our partners over there that it has adjusted back up now, we would be able to pull out more and therefore our return on investment would be quite a bit higher than that as well. And that's expected. I mean, guys over there that do these deals, they don't go for deals that provide any less, really.
Jumping into the mindset side of things, Paul and Pascal share whiles their past and vision for the future that pushed them to use property as a vehicle for financial freedom.
I think both of us have alluded to sort of our upbringings and our parents and generationally. My parents, as well as Pascal's, were quite reserved and with money, and there was a lot of fear around money. I think, you know, some of my family members lost a bit in bad investments, not property, but just putting money with the wrong person. As I was being brought up, the language around money was quite negative. Money doesn't grow on trees. Money is the root of all evil. That kind of language. So I never really saw any of these opportunities. So I think for me, it was about shifting my belief systems around money and how that and how money works and what it means to me and how I'm going to use it. So really, out of all of this, we want freedom. We want to be able to support our families. And we want to be able to live a comfortable life. And it's not about having super fast cars and private jets. It's, for us, it's just about, and this is the point of being financially free, is not all of that. Being financially free is literally just being able to pay all of your expenses and have a little bit left over without having to work if you don't want to.
Yeah, probably the optimal word to put underline and in capital letters with exclamation marks is freedom. And it means for us, we've seen our parents go through retirement, and my parents stayed in jobs where they weren't being treated that well and they weren't enjoying it, and they had to stay in those jobs because they needed to get as much as they possibly could before they retired. And I would have really loved if they'd been in the position to free themselves of that, or to just say, hey, screw it, it's not worth it, 5 years before that, and save a bit of extra hair loss and things like that. So we want to be able to do that, and we understand as well the way that the world's going in terms of jobs, that there won't be as many jobs in the future. So if they're finding it hard now, I mean, trying to find a new job as a 61-year-old is not easy now. So it's not going to be easy in the future, and the government is certainly not going to be able to support us with the growing populations and the decreasing amount of jobs. So we want to be able to create that freedom for ourselves, both to protect ourselves and our children from that, but also I'd really love to be able to help out our parents when we get to the stage where we are able to do that.
With such inspiring goals to work towards, what types of educational resources did Paul and Pasco go through in order to know what they know today?
So we've done a number of property education, so workshops, mentorships and that kind of thing. So, but actually, where a lot of our education has come from is a lot of reading, a lot of podcasts, a lot of workshops. And one of the biggest things is networking and growing around us like-minded people who have similar passions, similar values, and learning from each other. That's been massive. And so as many courses as you can do, I think you can do courses until the cows come home, but really the education comes from taking action and having the right team around you that you can learn from and trust. And so they can lift you and you can lift them.
I'd probably like to add to that podcasts as well. We've listened to a lot of podcasts. There's a lot of UK podcasts as well about investing in the UK. And other than that, School of Hard Knocks, I think so many of our lessons have come from almost really messing it up. And that's by the grace of God, we sort of didn't have to lose all that money, but there's no better way to instill a lesson that you'll never forget than coming really, really close.
Speaking of lessons, both Paul and Pascal share some of the books they've read that they've recommended aspiring or seasonal investors to learn and read from too.
I've probably got a couple. Pascal's probably got a couple as well. A really good book I read, which was around procrastination. It was actually it was for creators initially. It was written for creators. A book by Stephen Pressfield called War of Art. So opposite to Art of War, War of Art. And it was about, first half was about understanding what is procrastination and why do we not take action on things. And that was massive for me because I read it in my 20s. And from reading that book, and the other half of the book there is then how to become a professional. And it wasn't in the traditional sense. It was more of, if you're living life making false promises and letting people down, are you really a professional? If you're saying you will do something and then finding an excuse not to do it, are you really a professional? So it was about stepping up into being the professional at life. And that was a big, big book for me. It's a very small book, very easy book to read, but it was a big lesson. That was a big one. And there's a couple more, Pascal.
Yeah, one of the ones that really helped my mindset was The Slight Edge, because that's Jeff Olson, because I can see a pattern in my life leading up to this point where I would give something a go, kind of get on a roll with it, but then give up before I had got anywhere near mastery of anything. And it just really, really illustrated how the imperceptible progress that you have daily adds up to huge things over time if we just have faith and stick at it and know where we're going. So that was huge for me. I needed that book. But there's another small book that's called Go For No, And it's actually a book for salespeople about pushing through the rejection. But the huge lesson from that was about failure and how instead of running from failure towards success, we have to go through failure in order to get to success. And that was a real change in perception for me and has made me be a little bit more friends with failure in our life.
Expanding on this idea of seeing failure as your friend, Paul also shares his take on why it's important to make mistakes as much as it is to succeed.
There's probably not one business in the world that hasn't had a fail, you know, and I think any success has to come about via failure. You learn from a failure, therefore you adapt and pivot, and you then therefore success ensues. So I mean, failure is a part of it. You can't avoid it. And that's why we can't run away.
With such reflective thoughts on mindset and failure, as well as success, Paul and Pascal take a moment to tell us the best advice they've ever received.
Actually, I've been a few months ago watching a fair bit of Jordan Peterson. Love him or not, he's got some good insights. And he talked about judgment, and he said, you know, before, when you meet someone, when you're talking to someone, before you judge, think about perhaps that, is it possible that that person may have something I could learn from them? So if I actually listen to them, there's always something I could probably learn from that person. And that for me was great, just to not always jump to conclusion about a person and give them the opportunity for me to learn from them. That was a big lesson for me. Pascal?
Perhaps one that sticks out for me is that sometimes you need to ask for forgiveness instead of permission. And it might not work in every situation, but it just helps. Otherwise, sometimes you can become just, stagnated or just you come to a halt and you can't move forward. But sometimes just move forward anyway. And if you have to say sorry or ask forgiveness later on, then so be it.
And the advice they would have personally given themselves 10 years ago.
I would say to myself, buy a property and then buy another one and another one. Because I didn't start early enough. I was in my 30s really when I started investing properly. And so I would probably say, just get on board, take action. You're young and you've got many years to make some mistakes and then recover from those mistakes. I think that's one thing, you know, not enough people start young enough. They could be, you know, easily able to pop out the top of their business or, you know, let's say retire or get out of the rat race, whatever you want to call it, much earlier if they start earlier. And then I'd say also learn about compounding interest, because that is a very simple way of getting started and using compounding to build an amass amount of money over the period of time, you know, being patient over a period of time.
And for you, Pascal?
Mine would be, on the practical side, it would be to put my money into index funds for the compounding, because I was really geeky with money. I still am. I'm really geeky with money when I was young, and I could save really, really well. And with the power of time, even if I had planned to invest in property, even just putting that money and letting it compound for 10 years would have done great things. I didn't learn about index funds and compounding interest until I think my late 20s or early 30s. So, and then the other one on a personal note would be to learn how to laugh at myself. I was, I think, family friends described me as the most solemn child that they'd ever seen. And I don't think that people that know me now would think that is true. I'm not the clown of the party, but I can take things lightly. But I spent a lot of my early years and my teens just wrapped in knots because I was taking everything so seriously, most of all myself. So there is power in just being able to laugh something off and laugh at yourself.
While the past is something they can't change, both have been on a wonderful property journey so far, and thus share what they're most excited for looking 5 years into the future.
I'd say it would be the UK. I'm so excited about, because we talked about there's the HMO that we did, and I think we only need a couple more of those to get ourselves to the kind of cash flow where we can stop working our day jobs. And so that is super exciting to see that, the light at the end of the tunnel. But like I said, that's just the small ones. There are these bigger ones, these really, like say an old pub, buying an old pub and converting that into a number of units or into a big HMO, and just working with our partners over there to do some of those kinds of projects, or partnering with people from Australia to do those kinds of projects, or helping other people over this side of the world to do those kinds of projects as well.
From our sort of network here and friends and so on online, and from our Facebook group, sort of asking what we're up to, and so it's really cool to be able to share this journey with you and anyone listening. So that's exciting for us, just to share our information, share our knowledge, and show that it is actually possible to get into it and get out of it as well a little earlier than we think. You know, we don't just need one property over 30 years. You can do really well. On a cash flow basis, at least, with different and slightly different models, slightly out-of-the-box models.
On a final note, Paul and Pascal take a moment to reflect on what they believe all their success have been so far. Has occurred due to skill, intelligence, and hard work, or was it on luck?
Somebody said to me once, they said, luck is built up of hard work and persistence. So any luck that we've had is, I think, built up of deciding to take action. And like the book that Pascal mentioned, The Slight Edge, is just taking action in incremental ways every single day, and then the luck happens. So, I think there's a lot of there's a certain amount of synchronicity that I think can happen when you're, you know, working on a project or anything like that, where things align really well, and you're like, that was fortunate, and so you could call that luck. But I think sometimes it's about taking action.
Yeah. I have a personal philosophy on life that you do everything you can do within your power really well, and that is by all means your responsibility, but there's going to be a whole load out there that is out of your control. So I like to have faith, or I believe in God, so believe that things will turn out the way they're supposed to, and just leave it up to that. So whether you want to call that luck or not, that's probably the part of luck that, yeah, some of that has happened and some of that has been a contributor to our success. And I think that there's no one in the world that could say absolutely everything is under their absolute control. Mm. There's a book as well, also The Richest Man in Babylon, and there's a really great section of that that's about luck and debunking how people get lucky. I think it's quite interesting. A lot of people in the UK say to Paul, oh, you're so lucky that you live in Australia, and we're kind of thinking, well, how much of that is luck, really?
It's hard work getting here.
With such wonderful advice, tips and stories shared, here are some of the ways you can get in contact with Paul and Pascal Avril.
We'd absolutely love, if this is an opportunity to mention it for anyone listening who wants to have a look at our Facebook group. It's called PINANZ, P-I-N-A-N-Z, Property Investor Network Australia and New Zealand. And it's just a small growing group at the moment, where it's really about sharing knowledge, sharing insights, tips, tricks, and so on. And there's a thread in there for promoting your business, which we kind of try and keep separate from the main feed, because we want that to be about shared knowledge and networking. That's on Facebook, P-I-N-A-N-Z. We're also both on Facebook. It's not hard to find us. If you're including my name in your show notes, if you Google me, you'll probably find my podcast, which is called The Man Bits Podcast. It's straight up chat about men's health, which is a side project. Pretty easy to find us.
Thank you to Paul and Pascal Avril, our guests on this episode of Property Investory. If you want to hear more about their journey, then visit our website at propertyinvestory.com.au.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.